morning. Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to hear it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Catherine Kidd and Jill Batson, poets, writers, performers, about an upcoming poetry festival, spoken word festival called Stir. Right now, I would like to welcome Nancy King. She is the author of the new novels Morning Light and Woman Walking, published by Atelier Press, and she will be doing an event tomorrow, Friday, September 12th, from 5 to 7 at El Museo Cultural. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So these are two books that came out pretty much simultaneously, and the theme, continual themes in both books is the theme of storytelling itself, the power of story.
That's right.
What led you to explore this through fiction?
Well, when I was a little girl, to get out of the way of the world, I would hide under a piece of furniture or behind something, close my eyes, and turn on the theater in my head and tell myself stories. And stories have played an important part in my life, all through my life. When I was sick in 1985, I think it was stories that kept me going, because as I got better, different parts of the story would seem more important. And then I realized, when I had stabilized, I had actually told myself the whole story. But these were traditional stories, some even coming from this part of the world.
So what are some of your favorite or most important stories from your early life and going forward?
Traditional stories or
anything
stories
that really affected you?
Well, when I was a little girl, there weren't many books about girls doing great things. It was always boys. But there were stories from Russia, like Petrushka, who did good things, and I made up stories where girls did marvelous feats and were great heroines and always solved the problems.
And so the hero or heroine archetype was important to you?
Yes, because I think, well, whatever children experience, they think is normal. And if you don't like normal, you have to do something about it, and all I could do about it was make up stories.
All you could do about what?
Making my life better.
So the heroine in your story, Morning Light, is, I mean, it's an unbelievable story that has, you know, assault and battery and rape and incest and child abuse and violence against women and disease and I mean, this is a cavalcade of horror. I wondered if, because, and the girl at the beginning of the book talks about, the woman talks about being a girl and hiding under the bed. Is this semi-autobiographical?
Well, what I prefer to say is it's Anna's story filtered through my experience. And you make it sound very grim.
It is grim.
No, it isn't grim. At least I don't think so. I mean, Anna has a capacity for telling stories, and she works very closely with the children she teaches, and she's a really warm and loving person. But her private life is besieged by demons, and it's only when she becomes ill and is in the hospital and two nurses really push through her barriers that her memories come back, her stories come back, and she finds a way to negotiate her life in different terms. And I think that's joyful.
So the book is Morning Light. At the same time, there really is, and it's set in, well, the heroine Anna is born in 1950, so it's set sort of in the 70s and the 80s.
Yes.
And there is a kind of early feminist, even pre-feminist, aspect to her life, where she marries a guy who seems nice but really is rather awful, and she doesn't know how to stand up to him at first. That's something that I guess your generation dealt with a lot.
Well, when I was 13, which would have been 1949, I put a sign on a chalkboard saying this camp is a chauvinist camp because they don't allow girls to play baseball. Unfortunately, someone saw me and said, well, if you want to play, go ahead. And I was only a mediocre athlete, and the boys taunted and teased me, and that was the end of my co-ed baseball career. But I think I was always aware of injustice, no matter where it was. And part of my teaching was founded on making a classroom safe for everybody. And I think that's what Anna's trying to do. She's trying to make the world better for her kids and ultimately for herself.
Now, she's an interesting character in the sense that she wants to really teach kids who've had a hard time rather than nice middle-class private school kids. Is that also your story? I kept wondering.
Lord. Well, I did teach in a school that wasn't middle class. It was upper class. I had Rockefellers and debutantes. And it was a very wealthy school, and I was supposed to be teaching dance. And the person who taught before me would create a pageant where the girls would take poses and there would be a little music and the parents would clap. And I thought that was just perfectly awful. So when I got the job, I told the headmaster that I wasn't going to do that. I was going to have the girls choreograph a dance concert and that they would do their own choreography and I would help them with it. And he kind of gulped and said, fine. The only problem was the girls didn't believe me. And there were two girls who hadn't done any choreography. And the night before the concert, I got some calls from parents saying, my daughters are very upset. What are you going to do about it? And I said, well, I think you need to ask your daughters what they are going to do about it. It's their concert, not mine.
You mean they didn't believe that you were going to actually put them on stage?
That's right.
What happened?
Well, I don't really know what happened, but we were going to have a rehearsal just before the concert. And although if looks could kill, I would have been dead, those girls did have something to put on, and the dance concert did go on as scheduled with every girl doing her own choreography. And I did get my contract renewed.
But that was the upper-class girls. You also taught a whole different set of populations.
Yeah, I also taught Head Start, and I saw how devastating it is when children don't have much language, are used to being hit, and not having adequate meals, not having adequate time to think through problems. And I tried to make things better for them by giving them a chance to explore and also to achieve.
Now, one of the things that this character goes through is the talking about and experiencing the power of storytelling for young people, for very young kids, especially in language acquisition. Is that your experience as well?
Right. When I taught Head Start, my son, who was 6, was in the class, and I was teaching 4- and 5-year-olds. And my son was like a grandfather compared to the children I was teaching.
In the sense that he had more verbal ability?
Yes, more language, more vocabulary, more facility with creating stories. And so I would start a story, and I would say, once upon a time there was a little girl. And then I would look to the little girl on my left, and she would say, and she was just wonderful. And then she would nod, and so we would have a story that the group would tell. We also used to sing while we were working, and that also developed language. And by the end of the time, it was a summer program, my children really had greatly improved language capacity, and they enjoyed telling each other stories.
We're talking to Nancy King, author of the novels Morning Light and Woman Walking. Were you able to follow up? This is something I always wonder with teachers, whether they are able to follow up in the years and even decades to come, how their students went on in their lives.
Well, I spent most of my time at the University of Delaware teaching, and I have heard one of my oldest students, you could say, was in a production I did in 1966, and I'm still in touch with him. And occasionally I will meet children who, this was earlier on, who had had me as a teacher, and they would come up and say, Miss King, I got a story for you. And they would tell me a story. So I think that some things do carry on if it's incorporated into the children's being rather than superimposed by someone.
Now, your book, Woman Walking, is not only a story, but it's illustrated, and part of the event tomorrow night at El Museo Cultural, which is from 5 to 7, is your weavings and Maureen Burdock's illustrations from the book.
Yes. When I wrote A Woman Walking, or at least the first version was 1983, and I put it away, it came out as a response to stress, and I didn't really know what I was doing. And soon I had about 5 or 6 chapters, and I would show it to friends, and they would keep saying, what happened? And eventually, it became an episodic story. And over the years, I worked on it, but it always had this kind of psychological pull, which made it hard to really edit it. So when I decided that I would like to work on it, I called Cindy Green, and I asked her, one, if she thought it was worth working on, and two, if she was willing to edit it. And she read it and was excited about it, and she said, you know, you ought to talk to Maureen. She could really make this book a wonderful book. So I did talk to Maureen, and when it turned out, when she heard I was a weaver, she said, let me come and see your weavings. And so the illustrations for A Woman Walking are sort of stimulated by my weavings. The other thing that Cindy and Maureen and I agreed on was that we wanted the book to have a kind of old look, because it's written as a folktale.
Right.
And the first sentence goes, long ago in a place far away.
Right.
So immediately you know this is not a contemporary novel. And I think Maureen did a wonderful job illustrating the book in a way that supports the novel. And in the course of the novel, Ninan, the storyteller, becomes a storyteller. So her stories are interwoven with the novel, and Maureen found a wonderful way to make that physically evident as well.
Would you like to read a little bit from, maybe from A Woman Walking?
Okay, this is a little bit of a story that Ninan tells. It's about 3/4 of the way through the book, and her stories are getting fuller and better as she develops confidence. This is a story she tells. There was darkness in every direction. Before light was brought to the people, they moved around, using only touch and sound. No one strayed far from the places that were known. To do so meant death from cold or starvation or loneliness. No one asked if this was all there was. This was the way the world was. Everyone knew this, until one day. A creature suddenly fell from the dark sky, bleeding, hungry, almost lifeless. No one had ever experienced anything like it. Some people were frightened and moved away. Others stood, not knowing what to do. 2 women moved slowly toward what it was, feeling their way, listening to the sound of its cries, smelling its spilled blood, waiting to see if it would rise by itself. It did not. The 2 women touched the creature lying quietly at the edge of life and knew they must act quickly if it was not to die. Even though they knew it might not live, 1 woman gently cradled the creature, hoping her warmth would be something soothing while she stopped the bleeding. The other brought water and food, which she crushed with the water, making it into a paste which she placed on the creature's beak, gently wetting its mouth with the nourishment. It did not move. The woman tenderly opened its mouth and dripped water into its throat. Then she massaged the creature's throat until it swallowed, while her friend cradled it. She slowly fed it until the paste and the droplets of water were gone. There was nothing to do but wait and hope. All day the women cared for the creature, waiting, sensing its struggle to breathe, hearing its rasping breath, though it did not move. The women fell asleep with the creature cradled between them. Sometime after they had been sleeping deeply, fluttering awakened the women. The creature was moving. The women fed it more water and food, feeling awe as the creature took a few steps. The women held their breath, afraid to startle it. The creature shook itself and flew over the women, returning to the space between them. When the creature first spoke, the women did not understand its words, but it continued talking until the women learned. What the creature told them was amazing. I come from a land of color, from light and warmth. I will show you where it is. You will never be cold again. You are small and we are big, said Janina. What is color? What is light? Asked Alora. It is true that I am small and you are big, but if you do what I say, all will be well. Janina smiled. She was ready. I cannot tell you what color is. You must see it for yourself. And light, too. I can only say it is not what you know, and nothing I can describe. I will follow you, said Alora, to the color and light. We will follow you, added Janina. Tell us what to do. When the 2 women told the others they were going to leave, that they planned to follow the creature wherever it took them, some people cried and begged them not to go, predicting they would suffer terribly. Others said they were foolish. A few, very few, only 2 actually, asked if they could come. Although the women agreed, when it was time to leave, only Alora and Janina held on to the creature's tail as it flew over a landscape they could not have imagined. This is part of a story that Ninon tells a woman she's met on her travels, and the two women have become really good friends, and they know they may not see each other for a while, and yet they feel so close to each other. So the woman gives Ninon an unfinished basket to finish, and Ninon gives this story, an unfinished story, for her friend to finish, so that when they are working on the basket in the story, they will be thinking of each other, and in hopes that when they meet again, one will give the story and the other the basket.
We're talking to Nancy King. Let's go back to Morning Light. You say it's not grim. I say it's pretty heavy duty. But there's a lot going on in that. A lot of tough stuff going on in this book. But would you like to read maybe a page from that?
Sure. This is the opening. Sometimes I think I have two minds, and the one I like best tells the longest to get strong enough to tell the other to go to hell. I wish I knew what would speed up the process. As a child, when I was in need of consolation, I crawled under my bed or hid behind a large upholstered chair we had in the living room, any place I couldn't be seen. Then I'd close my eyes, imagining myself in another world, and pretend I was a heroine performing amazing feats in spite of fierce monsters or soldiers in thick armor. In my stories, I was always loved and cherished and honored and wanted. I even had an imaginary companion I created after reading a collection of Aboriginal myths. I don't know where he went or how I lost my stories, but they're gone. After graduation, when most of my classmates marched in twos from the doors of college advancing toward the arc of marriage, loneliness was the least of it. There was no chance of my getting on board. I was stranded on an island while the arc kept moving further and faster away. I watched them leave, wondering if my turn would ever come. You need a mate to climb the gangplank, and none of my male encounters stayed the night, much less the course. From the outside, I didn't look much different from the women in my classes. We all wore short skirts or bell-bottom hip-huggers, Indian prints, and beads. I wore my earrings long, dangling, and shimmering, having spent hours meandering in and out of jewelry shops on West 4th Street in Greenwich Village that catered to low budgets and active imaginations. Like many of the girls, my hair was long enough to braid in a single plait that knocked against my butt as I walked. Still, when I looked at my classmates, I felt different. And as I watched them choose spouses and careers, I felt pushed and pulled by mysterious forces that make me wonder about my inability to make choices. Sartre wrote that choosing not to choose was still a choice, yet he didn't explain how will becomes so paralyzed you can't remember having a choice to make.
So these two books came out at the same time from Atelier Press. Tell us about this press.
Atelier Books is a small Santa Fe press, and the publisher is trying to encourage people to have works published who might not otherwise find a press. And all the books are available in local bookstores, and if they don't have them, they can order them. And of course, they'll be for sale at El Museo Cultural tomorrow night. And
that's from 5 to 7 on Friday afternoon here in Santa Fe.
And if anybody would like more information about them, they could check my website, which is nancykingstories.com.
So, Nancy King, storyteller, thank you very much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
And the books are called A Woman Walking and Morning Light. We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Jill Batson. She's a poet. She's an organizer of the upcoming poetry festival, I guess you would call it, STIR, a festival of words. We're joined by Catherine Kidd, who's a writer-performer who will be at this festival. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
And let's talk first of all about what STIR is. We don't usually cover Albuquerque events, but since our signal now reaches down to Albuquerque, we're delighted to be doing a little bit more of this. What do you call this? Quote-unquote spoken word performance?
STIR is, we've decided to call it STIR because it kind of mixes up all the kind of words. So we have a whole plethora of spoken word, which runs the gamut from page poetry to spoken word to slam to all those things. And it's a three-day event. It encompasses workshops, round tables, all sorts of different sorts of readings. There's a book fair. There's stuff for youth, there's a poetry picnic, and there's like tons of stuff, and there's 80 poets, and several, or actually quite a few of whom, are from Santa Fe.
So a festival like this, Does it tend to attract mostly other poets and writers? Is this something for the family to come to?
Well, yeah, definitely, because, you know, as I said, we have a picnic and we have a brown bag lunch and we have, kids are welcome too. And it's because it's all day, every day, Friday, Saturday and Sunday, you know, it's the sort of thing that you can just tool around to different venues. And I don't know what the scene is like in Albuquerque, but I know that any other festival I've organized, you know, you get a real cross range of people coming, and that's not just poets, that's people who are just interested in these kind of freaky word people.
Freaky word people, two of whom are sitting at the table with us right now.
A freaky word person.
And this is at the Harwood Arts Center, by the way, in Albuquerque, which is at 1114 7th Street Northwest in Albuquerque. We'll give all the information at the end of the show. You are, Catherine, a writer, performer. You work in various media, poetry, fiction.
Yeah, I think it was a matter of trying to find a way to combine my different loves or my different interests and try to call it a unified art form. So I started out as an actor and found that just didn't feed my brain and my soul enough. So I quit that and traveled for a long time when I started writing, and then I had to find a way to mix the physical activity of representing a text with your body with writing, and so that's how I came up with writing and performing these stories, because it's cerebral, it's physical, it's a little bit of everything.
Now some of your fiction, I mean, you have a novel called Missing the Ark sitting right here on the table. And you work with some of that material in your performances. Do you change it when you go to the stage? I mean, are the written word and the performed word really different?
They're very much different. I mean, the novel I've been working on since the beginning of time. It's only come out last year, but I've actually been working on that for as long as I've been.
Since the flood?
Yeah, since the flood, basically. I've been performing texts for about 12 years, and I've been working on the novel for 10, so there you go. I think that novel writing is a very solitary activity, and if I did only that, I think I'd become a hermit, I'd become a recluse, while performance is, it's a collective thing, it's a temporal art form like dance or music, and the whole room is involved, so it has that, that community spirit that writing by itself doesn't have. I think I'd kind of starve in some way if I only wrote and didn't have a sense of the community that receives that art. And
I suppose people who have a gift for fiction writing but also kind of extroverted personality have to really do something, otherwise you go nuts.
Your introvert and your extrovert have to meet and shake hands, basically. Yeah.
So how do you, when you take a piece from your novel that you want to do on stage, how do you rework it?
Some things I write to perform start out that way. I mean, like this book here, Bipolar Bear, this is all performance.
I love that title, I have to say.
Thank you very much. It was based on the polar bear that used to live in the Vancouver Zoo, who was known to walk backwards, and according to polar bear psychologists, it was because he was out of his mind. But I thought, if I were hanging out on the ice caps and all of a sudden woke up in jail, I think I'd be kind of backing up too, trying to get back to where I came from. So yeah, that was the bear that inspired that title.
You work a lot with animals in your work, in your fiction.
Yeah, I read a lot of biology and zoology because I like to find metaphors for the human condition in the lives of other species, because we've written all this stuff about all the other critters we share the world with as though, we're humans, we're naming and sorting and categorizing you, rather than seeing them all as teachers so what we've written about them could as well be mirrors to ourselves, and that's kind of my main interest, is rather than looking at us as only stewards of the rest of the planet, because we haven't done the best job of that.
Not exactly.
Yeah. To look to these other creatures and see what we can learn about ourselves that way. So a lot of my poems start with one species and kind of expand to a story from there.
I think it's really interesting and important to think about the way we observe, for example, the natural world through mm-hmm. science versus the way we observe it through poetry.
I think at the root of my artistic motives or something would be encouraging a dialogue, more conversation between poetic language and scientific language. I guess I believe in a kind of poetic taxonomy, a way of naming and understanding the world that admits more subtle sensibilities, emotional sensibilities, rather than, only naming and ranking things as though we were Lord God Almighty kind of thing. I think that we, rather than treating everything else in the world as an object, we're all subjects and should. Well.
I know. I mean, I think that conversation. I have this sense because of conversations that I've been having both on and off the air mm-hmm. that a dialogue between art and science and a kind of merging we're just on the cusp of something very interesting.
I think so. I see it more and more. It seems to, maybe a few years ago it would have been a kind of flaky idea, and I think that's, we live in a time where I think humans are needing to adopt a kind of humility because we see how many of our ideas haven't worked very well. So I think, I think you're right that the time is right to for that to happen, for there to be more overlap between art and science. Yeah.
Now, taxidermy is a metaphor that you use in your work?
Yeah, I guess this was one of my very earliest poems was called Everything I Know About Love I Learned from Taxidermy, which now sounds like a very cynical title to me. But at the time, I guess I was thinking about those relationships that look alive from a distance. They look quite cute. And then you move in and you realize, oh dear, their hearts aren't beating anymore and they have this kind of glazed expression and they haven't been animated for quite some time. So that's an example of, just using animals as a metaphor for humans. But a later metaphor for love came from this sea creature called a sea peach. Here's a great thing for radio, a picture of one.
Hold it up to the microphone.
Hold it up to the microphone. It's a sea creature that almost exactly resembles a human heart. And it lives...
It really does.
It really does, doesn't it? It takes food and oxygen through one of those siphons at the top and expels little tadpoles through the other, which reroot and grow into more of these heart-shaped things. So in the context of that poem, it was a metaphor for love because of its groundedness, its grace, and its ability to balance giving and taking. That inspired me. I would like to be that grounded and like to feel that kind of inhale-exhale balance between what I take in and what I'm able to give back to the world.
I suppose that's essential for anybody who's an artist.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's people who give and give and give and give and give until there's these sort of spiritual wraith-like things with nothing left. And then there's other people who take and take and take and consume until they just, can't move in whatever way. And, I think as a human being at all, I think it's necessary to try to find some balance. I mean, that's what it is to be fulfilled, isn't it? To feel like you're giving back what you take in some way.
We're talking to writer and performer Catherine Kidd. Would you like to read from some of your work?
Yeah, I was trying to choose. Most of the animal poems are a bit long, so
we've got
time. Well. It would be better to do a section of it, because the one I was thinking about, for instance, is, 15 minutes long or something like that. So I could do the first couple of minutes.
Okay.
I was thinking of a poem that is called The Flying Lizard. I chose it because it's about an iguana
and we're in iguana country?
Yeah, we're in iguana country.
Kinda.
It's actually based on a true story of an iguana who leapt from a two-story window. I lived with this iguana, a 4-foot free-range iguana, who leapt from a two-story...
In your house?
Yes, got along well with my cat and was sort of crawled the climbed the curtains and whatnot.
And then it attempted suicide.
Well, I saw it as, in the context of the poem, it's kind of a metaphor for those times in your life where you just gotta jump, even though you don't know what the consequences of your actions are going to be, but there's the open window of opportunity and you just got to leap. As it turned out, with this iguana, it was picked up by a guy in a pickup truck, and anyway, I got the iguana back in the end. I can do the first couple of minutes of that poem, first few minutes.
We're talking to poet Catherine Kidd.
This is the beginning of The Flying Lizard. Crossing the floor like a little tiny dinosaur, my iguana looks happy, but how do I know if I should plant him a tree so he can live here with me, or buy a motorbike and drive him back to Mexico? I called you long distance to inquire why you'd left the window open, coughed, and coyly coiled the phone cord around my fingertip. An awkward pause transpired as the question struck us both as oddly emblematic of our whole relationship. When it comes to making choices, there's only three ways you can go. No. The alternative, the affirmative, the negative, and the alternative, which is neither yes nor no. With certain decisions, it's not bad to straddle one foot on each side, but your butt in the saddle, having made the first choice in the first place to sell the farm and split. You leave the rest to destiny. When you get there, you'll just know it. But when the choice in the first place is to simply stay or go, option three seems to habitually leave the window open. I mean, a body can stay or a body can go, but you're standing at the threshold, going nowhere, slow. And the hydro goes out and the weather comes in and you're never gone for long enough to wonder where you've been. Maybe door three is only there to buy some time for you to circle there and back and find there are really only two choices. The heart can say yes, or the heart can say no. But we shuffle to the doorstep, going nowhere, slow. So, lately a horoscope tells me to get in touch with my evil twin in a way which feels similar to play. Well, okay. So lately I've been living with a lizard who fell from the sky the other day. There's nothing much evil about him, even gets along with my cat. And as to his station as some kind of relation, we'll just have to see about that. Though he doesn't much outwardly resemble a twin, he also likes to climb the furniture and is vegetarian. And is there not some primitive part of the brain where lizard thoughts and human thoughts are on the same train? Like that train bound for Georgia, when all you need know is when to hold and when to fold, when to stay and when to go. Am I chill or do things suck? Am I safe or am I sorry? The lizard appears much clearer than me on these aspects of the story. Crossing the floor like a prehistoric herbivore, I love my iguana, but I don't have a clue how to tell if the iguana loves me too. So now I'm looking for a name for the reptile and appreciate your assistance. I need a name which references certain particulars of his existence, namely his falling through space. The name should have referred to certain events in the life of the reptile, but not be fallaciously fictive or fictitiously facile. I need a name which suits his face. Though the lizard himself might not so much care what name human roommates have pulled from the air and brought down on his little reptilian head. I don't want to saddle him with historical baggage to haul, because many of those who fall from the sky wind up dead. There's Icarus, who successfully flew for a spell, but his flying career didn't turn out too well. He waxed rather vainly, and no duh, he fell. Then someone suggested Lucifer, but to tell you the truth, I'd rather prefer not to adopt the iguana from hell. But now at this point, some may be wondering why this iguana came to fall down from the sky and wind up here in Montreal. I'd love to say he came from planet Claire, or somewhere else away out there. But he just fell from a window, that's all. So, I called you long distance to inquire why you'd left the window open. Coughed, and coyly coiled the phone cord around my fingertip. An awkward pause transpired as the question struck us both as oddly emblematic of our whole relationship. I'll stop there.
Catherine Kidd, so do you like Dr. Seuss?
Yes, I do. I have to say, in retrospect, that must be one of my biggest influences? It's kind of a favorite question, you know. Who are your influences? And I don't end up with a list of, you know, the Beats or other poets. They tend to be, I guess Aretha Franklin was the first voice I heard that made the hair stand up on my arm, so that was a huge influence. Tom Waits, because he had a gravelly voice like mine and liked to act as well as sing as well as write. And Dr. Seuss, because I love that kind of sing-songy rhyme that makes the text stick in your head. I mean, that's what rhyme was originally for, was a mnemonic device. I have a terrible memory for where I left my keys, but I can remember every single, you know, commercial ditty I heard since the age of six kind of thing. And so the rhyming thing for me was as much a way of finding the rhythm and helping me to memorize the text as anything else. Because it's very scary to go up on stage and realize you have to speak for the next hour or something without a book in front of you. So the rhyme helps me remember all that.
I suppose your training in theater helps you too.
Yeah, I really rejected the whole theater experience when I first got out of acting school. It seemed it was like all body and no mind. They didn't want you to think in there. They were like, Hamlet is a suicidal teenager. Play raging hormones. Don't play God, life, the universe, and everything. And I thought, the guy who wrote that stuff was very interested in the philosophical questions. So I quit theater school thinking I want to wrestle with the ideas too. And I went into philosophy and religious studies and found that, okay, so there I was only up in my head. And how do I find that balance? Isn't that, you know, the history of Western thought is this wrestling match between the body and the mind, and I don't think that split even exists.
Right.
I think
I know. What have we been wasting our time with all these centuries?
Exactly. We're a unified creature.
Very much so. In the book, Missing the Ark, which is a novel that you wrote. You were writing it for a long time, as you say. I read somewhere where you talked about the evolution and the process that your character, Agnes Underhill, goes through.
Mm-hmm.
You had to go through a process while you were writing it that was analogous to hers in order to write the book.
Well, in a lot of ways, I don't know specifically what you're thinking about, but I know
I haven't read it yet.
Yeah.
But I guess the thing that interested me when I was reading your writing about the book was when an author is writing a character, she has to struggle in ways that the character struggles in order to successfully write the character.
I think that's true. I mean, I wouldn't say that Agnes is me in that... Well, it's interesting, I just mentioned Hamlet. I think her tragic flaw is she can't make a decision to save her life, you know? So she sort of lets herself float along on other people's decisions until she realizes that she has to kind of take a stand. But also, if you're asking a character to sort of go into the basement of themselves and dig through all the boxes there, and which is what I was asking Agnes to do. She's a young mother. She didn't really mean to be. She's moved back in with her own mother and kind of has to retrace her steps and look into her past to figure out how she got to where she was. And so if I was asking her to do all this soul searching, I realized that this was work I hadn't even done myself. So, you know, somewhere at the beginning of my writing the book, my own father died, and I didn't really get to know him as well as I could have. So I had to go back and look at that stuff, and a lot of it is, you know, was really, really sad. But I felt like I had to get aboard that lifeboat, you know, go there if I was going to ask the character to go there. So writing a novel can, you know, really kind of strip you.
And I would think that once it's done, there's something cathartic about putting it to rest and having it exist between two covers and not in your head all the time anymore.
Absolutely. I love that it's, you know, it's here on the table and I can walk away and leave it there and it's not stuck to my head. That feels great. On the other hand, there really was a kind of postnatal, postpartum depression that I went through, just like Agnes goes through. I mean, in the book, she's got this baby and doesn't immediately take to motherhood. She doesn't feel that wonderful maternal, you know, she's sort of more like, who is this little person and why am I in this situation? And when the book came out, the first thing that happened was I also felt that kind of detachment for a while when something's been such a... It's more like the empty nest syndrome, I think, than postpartum. It's when something's been part of your life for so long, and then all of a sudden it's somebody else's, you know.
We're talking to Catherine Kidd. Jill Batson's been sitting very quietly. You are not only an organizer and of this event, STIR, which is happening this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, at the Harwood Arts Center in Albuquerque. You're a poet yourself, and I'd love to hear more about your work, and maybe you could read something as well.
Oh, you know, I'm reading at the festival, too, in a couple of places. One is for the Book Lung reading, which is at 516 Art. So we're doing a collaboration with the with 516, the gallery, where poets respond to the artwork in the gallery, and we've built this huge book, a kind of monumental book with all the poems in. And so I'll be reading there, and I'll be reading somewhere else. I think I'm mostly reading because I'm free.
Free is a big word. Yeah. Which kind of free?
You know, cheap.
That kind of free.
But yeah, I'm a poet. I mostly do work with other artists. I'm working on a choral requiem for 20 voices, which has just been commissioned by a big festival in Toronto for World AIDS Day in 2010. But it's an AIDS requiem. I have a libretto for a full-length opera coming up, also in 2010.
What's the opera about?
The opera is about. Obsession, love, death, sex, you know, all the operatic subjects,
right.
Really. But it focuses around a woman.
Hey, you could call your falling lizard Falstaff.
Good for you. That's the winner right there.
Sorry, go ahead, Jill.
Now, this opera focuses around a woman who's obsessed with beautiful things. It's called Netsuke, and if you know what a Netsuke is, they're the small object, Japanese objects, and a lot of the piece takes part in Japan. So yeah, that's the kind of what I do. I don't read very much, so this is kind of one of the things I'm going to be doing at the festival.
How did you put together the mix of poets? You brought Catherine in from Canada.
Yeah, you know, I used to organize a lot of things in Canada when I lived there, and so I have this, you know, great association with all the Canadian poets. So Kat's here. Also, Sherody Wilson is coming from Calgary. She's going to be reading on Friday. And Reggie Kabiko, who was on your show, is going to be doing his...
He's great.
Yeah, he's going to be doing his one-man show on Friday. And actually, all Friday's events are at places in on the campus of UNM. And he's going to be doing his one-man show, which will be hilarious. And it's at 10 o'clock because it is kind of restricted material, as you might imagine.
So this is after you put the kiddies to bed.
That's right, yeah. The kiddies can... or maybe not, you know, who knows?
Yeah, depending on the parents' choices. He's a gay Filipino-American poet from New York, I guess.
Yes, yeah. And he's on tour at the moment. He's doing... This is kind of like the unveiling of his show, actually, in Albuquerque, and he's going to be doing it later on this month in San Francisco. And we have other great poets. You know, we have Joy Harjo doing her lineup with the Aerodynamics Band on Saturday. That's kind of like the big show.
That's a great title. Arrow is in bow and arrow.
Yeah.
Aerodynamics.
Yeah, yeah. Huh. So that's happening on... that's the big event for Saturday. And then, of course, we're teaming up with the Church of Beethoven, who you've had on the show. You know, they're a weekly performance at the filling station in Albuquerque. And we have Arthur Z and Carol Muldaur and Rene Gregorio doing those, who will be the guest poets for the Church of Beethoven. So it's going to be...
And so the Church of Beethoven, I went actually to one of those morning shows. It's morning classical music concerts. They're just starting up in Santa Fe. We'll announce when the next one is on the Friday segment. But they had, for example, they played a, I think it was a string trio or a string quartet, and in between the movements, a poet read her poetry, and it was fabulous.
Yeah, and I actually did the Church of Beethoven as a poet a couple of weeks ago, and it's just a really fantastic venue in Albuquerque. It takes place at the filling station, which is a kind of little black box theatre, and the audience is just so near the musicians, and it's always really, really interesting to watch these like, world-class musicians play and then have these kind of poets pop up, and the audience just loves everything. It's really, really great.
So this is really poetry and music for the people from all walks of life. I love that we're getting away from this sort of false idea that was false in the first place, that art and poetry are somehow a kind of ivory tower activity.
Mm. Yeah, we're really working against that in this festival anyway. And we have over 80 poets coming. Because this is the inaugural festival, we have a lot of New Mexican poets from all over New Mexico, and you know the Canadians and the New Yorker. But next year, of course, we hope to, you know, flush that out with a few more people as we get funding.
So we're talking about the STIR Festival of Words, which is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. 22 events, visual poetry. I like also that you're both really working with music. I mean, you sing your poetry and recite your poetry
bits
with music.
Mm-hmm. I think part of being a poet is being drawn to the musicality of language. It's not just about the meanings of the words, it's about the sounds of the words and how tasty they are, in a way. And I think music sort of presents that, you know, is the kind of present in the sense of presenting a plate, in a way. It kind of enhances the tastiness of the words. Yeah.
On your website, Catherine Kidd, you also have some interesting little sort of YouTube-style videos, mm-hmm, that are visual, that have a music background,
yeah,
and you writing and singing your work. So it's really a multi-dimensional.
I was very fortunate to work with DJ Jack Beats, who's, I guess, originally from where in the States? I mean, he was in New York when I met him. No, he was in Boston when I met him. He now lives in Barcelona, but we worked together for, you know, a decade, and he's made these wonderful original beats specifically for the poems. And then there's often imagery. I like to take photographs, and my partner Jeff also likes to take photographs and film, so we're starting to mix that with the poems. I don't see any reason to, you know, restrict the different dimensions that you can bring to a poem and still call it poetry. Why not dance? Why not, you know, why not music and film? And
and as you said somewhere, if you're an artist, that encompasses whatever media you choose to do.
I definitely think so. I think that it's a kind of sensibility. It's a commitment to paying attention to things.
And for me, I think working with other mediums, I work with dancers as well as musicians, I think my motivation for doing that is because I kind of get bored with hearing my own voice, and I really like to be able to... and another thing is, I really like to kind of fake people into listening to poetry. You know, they come and they think they're seeing an opera or something, and actually what they're hearing is the libretto, which is all in haiku or something like that. So that's what I really enjoy about working... Yeah, the libretto.
Did you really write a libretto in haiku?
Yeah, the libretto for Netsuke is all in haiku.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Are you going to perform that here in Santa Fe?
Who knows? You know, if the Santa Fe Opera is listening.
And they're always listening.
Yeah, absolutely, I'm sure.
So, do you have anything that you want to read or recite before we go?
I have a poem that I like to do because I'm running out of time to do it since it's about Martha Stewart being jailed.
And, okay.
It's not really what I usually do, but it's anyway, it should give you some kind of laugh. Anyway.
Okay.
It's called Why You Should Be Jailed, Martha. Not because you got greedy or embezzled money. Not because I am jealous of your business acumen or that you never seem to age. But because you make me dissatisfied with my life. Every month when my Martha Stewart living arrives in the mailbox, I compare my life to chocolate box fantasies. Thumb the pages past Santa Fe cookout brunches, tips on how to wash your pet dog, hang the perfect family portrait, or give a simple but knockout party on your Catskills dog. Every month my heart wrenches its beat into longing. I want a whitewashed plank dock with wicker chairs to bask in at sunset. I want to be able to wash my dog with an expensive natural sponge and then just throw it away. And that's part of the poem. It just goes on about, you know, how I think Martha should have been jailed just for publishing that magazine.
Well, I love it. And Francisco Aguabella in the background for bringing it even more to life. Catherine Kidd's website is catkidd, CATKIDD.com. Jill Batson is poet and organizer of this event, STIR, at the Harwood Arts Center. For more information, people can call 820-0717. And it's September 12th, 13th, and 14th, tomorrow through Sunday. And for more information, you can also call the Harwood, 242-6367, extension 117. And the Harwood Arts Center is at 1114 7th Street Northwest in Albuquerque. Thank you so much, ladies, for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Tomorrow, Robert Knott and much, much more. Stay tuned to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Hasta la vista. Ciao.